Hi, this is Dr. Tom Rogers coming to you with a weekly podcast of what I call the Common Sense MD. Today we have a special guest on, and he's a really interesting and fascinating doctor that I have heard about for many years through my massage therapist, Carolyn Anderson. And she's just an amazing person that's really helped us out a lot with physical problems. As you age, you tend to get. So, Dr. Ross, I want you to introduce yourself. You're originally from Ukraine, and you now live in Phoenix, Arizona. So tell me a little bit about your upbringing and coming here to the United States. And we pray to God your country gets settled here pretty soon and everything gets peaceful over there. But tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got into this branch of medicine.
Thank you for inviting me. I really like the name of your podcast because common sense very frequently is not present.
So, it's not common.
Yeah, that's true. I'm fourth generation of physicians, so my family members, different physicians, and I was originally finished at Odessa Medical University with trauma and rehabilitation, with the surgery, and then I was in residency in Kyiv in Scientific Institute of Orthopedic Rehabilitation. And then after finished residency, I started to work as for the Ministry of Public Health, Ukraine Ministry of Public Health, in the Rehabilitation Commission. And we managed five medical resorts around the country. And I was responsible for continued education of the physicians and the therapists who worked there. And at the same time, I started my PhD. I finished PhD. And at that time, despite that I had pretty good position, the Chernobyl happened. And my daughter was born months before Chernobyl, and that created extreme havoc through the city, especially for the children who were growing up. And then one of the clinic from Manhattan, they saw our publications in the medical journals, and they asked if one of the physicians would like to move to the United States and be medical director. And that's how I got sort of the working visa through the clinic, first in Manhattan and then in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Well, you're so well qualified and obviously brilliant. You have a medical degree, a PhD, and you actually were near Chernobyl. That is fascinating to me that you experienced that and went through that. You must be really on edge a little bit about, you know, the news last night was Chernobyl was on there. That plant's in danger, am I right?
Yeah, and we actually were responsible for the rehabilitation of those who work in Chernobyl to calm it down. So I had not only it from the observational point of view, but actually from inside. And that is, it's difficult to imagine. So Kyiv is approximately 3 million people, was capital, and the chaos and everything unimaginable when one morning 3 million people freaking out. You cannot imagine what's going on the streets. It's like the only analogy is like Germans enter a city. That's only Nazi, I mean. It was unbelievable experience. People cannot imagine when the cluster of people who live so close, something happened, and they start to get out of the city, and you cannot. It's just unimaginable.
I can't imagine that. How far is Chernobyl from Kyiv?
It's approximately 150 kilometers, so it would be like, it's pretty close. Kyiv was lucky because the wind was blowing north, and it took all initial horrible radiation all the way to Finland. Finland actually killed entire livestock, which was outside at that day. It was just poison through entire North Europe. But then it changed, it started to blow south, and that started to blow over the Kyiv, and then children who grow, they have, because majority of the radiation came from iodine, radioactive iodine, and the children have retention of iodine in thyroid gland. That's why it was actually one of the contributing factors in the rise of thyroid cancer in Ukraine.
That is so fascinating. That we're glad you're here. And tell me a little bit about your passions in medicine. Obviously, you come from a fourth generation physician family, similar to me. So your passion with people is helping help their pain. Is that right? Is that over anything that you've, I mean, you've practiced in a lot of different fields, and from surgery to rehab. What is your driving passion behind what you do now?
And that is the major difference in views, because you see, here people, we have even branch of medicine called pain medicine, but you as a physician know that pain is the consequence. It's not the actual problem. The pain is pure generation by the brain based on the inappropriately functioning peripheral receptors. So from that perspective, if we're chasing the pain, we're technically speaking chasing the ghost. So the only solution for the pain is find where the trigger is, suffocate the trigger, and then restore the function. So this is what kind of, and the simplicity sometimes of the treatment, which people, you know, suffer for years, is amazing, because it is not so much therapy itself, but evaluation of the tissue, which allows you pinpoint where the problem actually happened. Then you address that, voila, and there is no pain as a result of it.
That's fascinating to me, because it's almost like the opposite approach that traditional medicine takes in this country, at least. I mean, you know, experiencing, like, I'm 69 years old. I have a lot of scoliosis, and as a result, I've had a lot of back pain. That, knock on wood, it's the only thing that's bothered me in my life is my lower back, and it's a constant daily thing that I get treatment for. But I often tell people, if you looked at my spine on an X-ray, it's as crooked as a politician. So I don't know about over there, but over here sometimes it gets crooked.
You don't know what the crooked politician look like. You need to go to Russia and Ukraine to see that.
I can imagine. But anyway, it's kind of a joke. But anyway, so I've often thought that, is this really a problem of my spine, or is it a problem of the fascia that is connecting to the bones? How do you approach that? I mean, you teach all these doctors and physical therapists, massage therapists. What's your gestalt on really what causes this in the first place? Can it be bad posture, poor sleeping habits, lack of muscle, injuries? What do you see most commonly?
No. If we're talking about scoliosis, that's different ball game, because if you already have scoliosis and you have deformation, there is no way it can be straightening by any therapy. The only what you can do, you can decompress curvature frequently to let patients function more efficiently. So therapy will not straighten the spine, especially if the curvature is significant. But then if you're looking for the, let's say, for the patients with scoliosis who go into physical therapy, let's say, and then physical therapy put them through the light repetitive exercise. But you see, the problem is you cannot, as a person with scoliosis, for example, exercise equally between the right and left side, because you have weakness and contractions on opposite side of the curvature. So the physical therapist or personal trainer need to actually design the exercise program, which from one point of view make muscles stronger on one side to prevent additional arching, and then stimulate muscle inside to restore some balance and communication. Because one of the reason of your pain dysfunction, you're absolutely right, is facial tension, because that is one of the components. But another important component is miscommunication between right and left side. The muscles in your scenario are not talking on the same language anymore, because they are not antagonist. This relationship of antagonist synergies are broken. So from that perspective, now what it does, it confuses the brain. And when it confuses the brain by different information coming from the different peripheral receptors on opposite side of the curvature, it additionally pushes, put brain in the position of overprotection, which additionally increases the curvature. And from that perspective, technically speaking, you have, or patients with scoliosis has three options. First of all, is manual decompression of the soft tissue. Secondly, regular exercise and swimming in the swimming pool, because it's only one place when force of gravity is not affecting this balance between both sides. And finally, it's inversion table as a decompression. When you have three components of that together, then you can live 150 a day from something else. But if it's not done, then it accumulates to the degree that it starts to bother. But that's not really on the problem. The problem is pediatricians. That's the problem. That's what I'm dealing on monthly basis. Because the way of how pediatricians see scoliosis is observation. And when the children start to develop early curvature, while doing treatment correctly, you can completely control curvature and prevent that from getting to the degree when it starts to affect the quality of the life. But unfortunately, pediatricians only confirm the presence of the scoliosis, and then don't they wait until they put child in the car seat if it's really bad. And if it's not, the important critical time is lost, because if the treatment and the adjustment are done early enough, you just completely prevent or even reverse curvature. That's what I had with my patients.
That is so fascinating. So what age are you talking about that this needs to be screened for? Obviously, the pediatrician looks at the back, but you're talking about an age that you need an X-ray maybe?
No, you. First of all, that's an important point, because even parents can be taught that. First of all, girls suffer more than boys. Secondly, it always runs on the in the family, not always, frequently runs in the family, especially along the female line. And why female suffer more? Because when we have bone growth spurts, especially during the summer, the female has, girls have smaller cross-section, a smaller power of the soft tissue to control the spine. And that's why it curves more and more frequently than boys. Now, we're talking approximately the first sign of curvature, not the curvature, but the vertebral rotation, because there is different stage of scoliosis. Zero stage, you don't see curvature yet. You can see only rotation of the vertebrae when the child bends forward. So if you're standing behind and ask child to bend forward, you can clearly see that these little bones, which called spinosus process, start to rotate in one direction. So usually it happens around 10, 12. It can happen around 14 as well. But the earlier it's happened, the more chances the curvature will be dramatic if it's nothing done. But that's what I see on our patients, because I have a lot of, I'm not specialized, but I have a lot of patients who refer their friends who has children with early stages. And if a treatment start and the changes in the behavior start too early, then you can completely prevent worsening scoliosis or even take degrees back. I have x-rays to prove it.
That is very fascinating to me. So females over males, as far as incidence, for sure. I've seen that. Age 10, everybody should be screened. So if their spinous processes are rotated a little bit, you need to take note. And then would you proceed with a spinal series of x-rays and see how bad it is?
Yes. I always suggest patients do x-ray and keep that as a baseline for their records. And then we do same x-ray in the same place every year to control progress. And if it's caught early enough, the X-ray shows exactly same position of the vertebrae without worsening.
That is really interesting and a good point for physicians. Now, let me ask you, so at what age does it become irreversible, would you say?
When they stop to grow. So 17, that's it. What you got at 17, 18, you're done. What you will have for the rest of your life. But this, and it's really pain in one area for the family to deal with that if scoliosis starts very early, 10, 11, because technically speaking, you're looking for 6-5 years of a lot of efforts. But at the same time, it's worth investment. Because if it goes to 35, 40 degrees, then it, or even more, then it requires surgical intervention, which you like two huge rods in inserted on both sides of the vertebra. And I have patients like that. They're in immense pain through the rest of their life, but you cannot live it without surgery because it affects function of the heart and the lungs.
Yeah.
So,
kind
of, so that's why when the time is lost at the beginning, and for my personal opinion, that is direct responsibility of pediatricians, because as soon as the early stages form, the pediatrician need to raise hell that the parents understand gravity of situation.
That is so true. And I bet you find in your practice or in our country that is very underdiagnosed. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. Because again, first of all, when pediatricians look at the, I specifically ask my patients and ask, did pediatrician look at your child? And they said, yeah, he looked on the, or she looked on her back and she said, it's everything fine. But in early stages, in zero stage, you cannot see that. You need to bend them forward all the way that they're reaching the floor, and then you see rotation. And if you're not seeing and you're not diagnosed at that stage, then the next stage you will actually see physical curvature, and that's different animal, because you already require much, much more efforts in the, and to stabilize the curvature.
You know, one thing I've seen in, especially it's worse now than it used to be, in this country, we have such obesity, even in our children, that sometimes it may be harder to tell. Is that, do you find that to be true? If they're so obese, is it going to be hard to detect?
No, still, you can detect it as long as if you don't see it, then you just run your finger through the spinosus process, and you can see, and feel deviation. If you don't see it, you can feel it.
Okay.
But obesity is definitely another aspect which contributing to scoliosis. Because now you have extra weight, and nowadays it is great to be obese because that's your personal opinion, and nobody talking about the consequence for the health, which is very unfortunate.
In my practice, I do a lot of obesity management. As a matter of fact, that's one reason I formed my own company, because as a regular family doctor, I just found myself putting people on one medicine after another for their diabetes, their hypertension, their hyperlipidemia. And when the problem was, they're obese and they didn't know how to eat. And then if you can solve that, then their whole life's going to go better.
Yeah, we have patients who stop insulin, stop anti-hypertensive medication. Everything normalizes. Everything is like new
everything.
Life.
Yeah,
and
everything.
It happened only because of the weight loss. That's
You're exactly right. I really got tuned into nutrition personally when two of my three children came down with type 1 diabetes at age 8 and 11. So I realized I didn't know much about nutrition, and that's why I went back and did the fellowship in functional medicine. And a lot of my practice today is geared on getting people leaner and stronger. And a lot of my patients are baby boomers. What type of patients do you like to see, or do you see in your practice? Is it mostly middle-aged, younger, older folks?
No, I have patients from young girls and or boys who was injured during sports competition to patients who in the 80s, and I don't have specific age. It depends from what they have. And so I cannot say that I work on baby boomers. I have a lot of young people with headache, for example, or with the pain in the neck due to the working on the computers and the looking on the, as a result of bad ergonomics. So it's a wide range of the age and abnormalities.
Would you say most of your practice is focused on the spine itself?
No, I do everything. When patients ask me what you do treatment-wise and what patients you're working with, I'm telling I do everything from the headache to impotence.
Interesting. Very because interesting.
I had patients actually publish articles on patients with erectile dysfunction, which was actually as a result of pudendal nerve neuralgia and the compression of pudendal nerve neuralgia with the pudendal canal restored blood flow.
That is so true. And a lot of times that's a sign, erectile dysfunction, of heart disease as well. I mean, sometimes it's a signal that some blood flow is going wrong. At what point, because I don't think most physicians in this country really focus much on utilizing physicians like yourself for people as they grow up and screening for this type of thing. I mean, obviously, if you can prevent it, it's better. Do you find that when they get to you, they should have come to you way earlier and maybe even gone to a massage therapist like Carolyn or somebody that can start working on these problems early?
Yes, that's exactly what I tell our students who enroll in the program. I tell them there is what we are sharing with you and what we will train you is not ultimate solution. It is consider yourself as emergency medicine physician. So it is first line of defense. After that, physical therapist may be needed. Maybe acupuncture can be added. But that's not what we train our students and therapists. We train them to control origin of the pain as soon as possible. Because that's number one priority. If you suffocate the trigger, then brain without a constant bombardment by the chronic pain stimuli start to reset. Postural changes start to reset gait, start to reset pelvis rotation, elevation of the shoulder. From that perspective, it's kind of, if the treatment done right, I will make this analogy. Imagine that you have a sandcastle built on the film. If you pull film under the sandcastle, everything will collapse. That's what medical massage and manual therapy does. It addresses the foundation of layers of dysfunction, brain built on top of each other, trying to deal with abnormality. And when you take the foundation, then brain start to bring everything together by the simple things. Go and wash your windows or go and walk through the desert. And that will actually, with time, reset and eliminate excessive protective reactions.
That's interesting. So when you train your therapist, do you have them watch a person walk, stand, just look at their posture and kind of see if they have a retracted scapula or a high riding shoulder? Just observation a lot of times leads to diagnosis and correcting asymmetries and things like that. Is that how you train your therapist?
No, because that is important information which therapists should consider. And this is, you're absolutely right, initial stages of visual observation. But what happened with the therapy, which unfortunately used inappropriately, the therapists try to address postural changes as an actual problem. But the postural changes, never actual problem. It's the brain reaction as a protection to the problem. Let's give you a simple example. You hit your leg against the table. And next morning you wake up and you start to limp. Who make decision that you will start to limp? You're not consciously saying, okay, now I'm limping, am I right? Someone else made decision for you on the subliminal level. So mm-hmm. that's what happened with the postural changes. You have rotation of the scapula, elevation of the shoulder. Million dollar question is, why? Why patient start to have rotation of the shoulder or elevation of the pelvis? That's not the problem. That's the consequence. That brain try to deal with the pain because we need to get to work. We need to drive to see physician or take child to the school. How can you do that if you're in pain? Brain create roadblocks. And these roadblocks will be seen as a postural change, which can lead you to correct decision, but you cannot treat that as a problem because you just knocking on the wrong door. You use that as the lead, find the trigger, kill that, and then body will take care about the rest of it.
That is interesting. That's so right, though. You know, you have those, what they call them, mu receptors in the brain that control pain. So what approaches in this country, we have an opiate epidemic, and the approach to most physicians and people want a pill for their pain. Have you noticed that? And now we have the opiate crisis, and these people are addicted to medications that may help them for 2 weeks, but after that they're just addicted. It doesn't help them at all, right?
You're absolutely right. That's horrible and unfortunate. My wife did research, and she said she found a statistic that every 10 minutes, 30 patients die from opioid crisis. This is ridiculous. But at the same time, I understand physicians. So physicians, while they're in the medical school here, they are not trained in anything else except medication and the surgery.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I was in medical school, I was part of the medical curriculum was acupuncture, herbology, medical massage. I passed exam in the medical school for the medical massage. So they did not do that you will practice that. They will give you a wider view that you will prescribe it and you will control execution. But here, if the patient in pain and the physician sent him to a physical therapist and it didn't work, the patient requests the answer, right? So he put pressure on the physician, and physician doesn't have any options anymore. So here is a opioid solution. And that
exactly
killed
right.
them. Unfortunately. Yeah.
The patient wants the pill, the easy way out, and the physician wants to get the patient out the door, and the easiest way is to write a prescription.
Yeah.
So they can turn them over, see more patients, make more money, and now you have the pharmaceutical companies pushing you to use all this stuff. And then down
every
the line, you realize quits working. And, then they affect their kidneys, liver, stomach, everything. So I'm one of the few physicians probably that is easy to jump on medical massage. A lot of times I'll see these patients and, they hurt all the time. And I go, have you ever had a medical massage? And they haven't. They may have gone to a massage therapist, but not like somebody like Carolyn does. I mean, that's a whole different ball game. It's, a lot of times it's not pleasant. It's not a frou-frou massage. It is working that fascia.
And the problem is the who is really losing are the patients, and that's what really disappointing, because they constantly knocking in our doors in the clinic, and solution was there, it was in your face, but nobody looked at the origin of, and everybody tried to fix the consequence. I'll give you, and I may send you pictures of. I had patients with pretty severe sciatica, and I help cure, everything fine. What I do usually after I recover them, then I send them for a couple of weeks to do regular thing and then see again if it holds. So she comes and she gets from the chair and they see that she limps again. And I think, Jesus Christ. So it's come back again. So, and then she saw my disappointment, saying, no, that's not my lower back. That's my foot. I think, what do you mean your foot? She said, I cannot step on my foot. So I look at her foot, and you, I can send you a picture. And there is two of her feet. One is like 30% wider than the normal one. And she actually has plantar fasciitis. But her brain and plantar fasciitis was triggered by the compression of sciatic nerve. And that was actually was the reason for the plantar fasciitis to develop. But brain cannot concentrate on two sources of pain at the same time. It will always take predominance. So predominance was compression of her L5 spinal nerve in the lower back. And she had pain in the bottom of the foot, but brain did not acknowledge that. I freed her from the pressure. Suddenly, she started to have horrible pain on the bottom of the foot. One particular reason, that the layers of the abnormality formed due to absence of appropriate therapy. And then, after the therapy, you have normal both feet, no pain, and I didn't see her for several years since. So that's why, unfortunately, patients are in the gap because there is no solution. I found actually article published in the physical therapy journal in 1955 by the head of the Pittsburgh physical therapy department in the Pittsburgh Medical School, and it was editorial article when she was saying, it was like almost crying. She's saying, "We're killing entire school, which we're famous for, by excluding this information from the education of physical therapists." And they eventually did. So right now, physical therapists are not doing that. Massage therapists have like slightest idea. And duos who may do that, they now practice regular massage medicine because there is shortage of the physicians to start with. And now who lost from all of that? Patients.
You know, you're so right when you said you can't hurt in two places at one time. I used to call it the pathway to pain when I would be working, like doing an injection in a knee or something. I would have my nurse pinch him on the other side, and it went a lot better. So I guess that's the way the TENS units work, right?
Yeah, absolutely right, because we use TENS unit. It's not only that. TENS unit, where we use TENS unit, I use TENS unit to help nerve recover from the pressure. So what I do, I place electrodes in the strategic locations along the inflamed nerve and send electricity through the nerve as a grader, which clear lines of the highway, which is under the snowstorm. So you need to, from one point of view, kill the trigger. But you know, the nerve is very sensitive tissue. If it's inflamed for some period of time or irritated, it stays inflamed for some period of time. That's where I put TENS unit as the next treatment option to help nerve recover by pushing electricity back and forth through the affected part of the nerve and open lines of the highway and remove traffic jam. And that gives a much better outcome.
It removes what now?
Traffic jam, so the
traffic action jam. Okay.
And that gets through the inflamed part of the nerve.
I get you. So that's why the TENS unit. Are you a fan of acupuncture, dry needling, that type of thing?
Dry needling is the gimmick. American Acupuncture Association even sue dry needling people for the incorrect presentation of ideas. So acupuncture by itself, I, you know, have basic training in it as well. It's a very powerful tool, but there is no, as you know, as a physician, there is no one modality which can work everywhere. Everybody have their own niche. So what I do within my niche. So for example, I have patient and I know the TENS unit will not help, for example, because the nerve was severely compromised, let's say, by the disc. You actually, or you have severe carpal tunnel with actual early stages of nerve part of the fibers become degenerated. So in such case, I have absolutely unbelievable acupuncturist here. She's a medical doctor as well, Dr. Shu in Phoenix, in Scottsdale. And I send patients to her when they're ready. But in cases, for example, of visceral disorders, that's where acupuncture become number one priority. And then what I'm doing becomes supplements. So it's always juggling where the chicken, where the egg. If you would like to work for the patient benefits, not from the professional ego perspective, I don't care to send someone who has more expertise. But the point is, it needs to be done in correct sequence. That's how you restore the function, from my perspective, at least.
That's very interesting. So if you have a patient that comes in and they have, obviously, they have chronic pain, whether it be in their shoulder, their scapula, their low back, their neck, how should they approach it? For our audience that's listening to this, how should they approach it? Because it's going to be tough for them. If they go to their doctor, they're probably not going to get the right treatment. Am I right?
That's the problem. That is really a problem because, let's say, that story of my life, basically on monthly basis in the clinic. Patient diagnosed with carpal tunnel, and he has carpal tunnel. There is no doubt. There is tingling on the palm. There is a weakening of the thinner muscles and everything like that. But the same carpal tunnel clinical symptoms can come from completely five different triggers located in completely different parts of the body, and they will always give exactly same clinical symptoms in early stages. It can be disc, it can be paravertebrals, it can be anterior scalenic muscle, it can be pectoralis minor, it can be pronator teres, and only after that, transfer carpal ligament in the wrist. And the therapist or physician do not have professional rights to treat carpal tunnel with all nerve conductance study, everything proved that it is. But they don't have in rights to treat that as a carpal tunnel if they didn't rule out all four, which is above that. Mm-hmm. And when all of them four are negative, then you use carpal tunnel therapy. Or the surgery if it's needed. But if one of them is positive, let's say anterior scalenic muscle, which in somatic medicine has nickname silent killer, it's completely different treatment. You're treating patient anterior neck, and then patient puzzled why you treat my neck while I have numbness on the palm. Because your numbness on the palm, not the problem. It's anterior scalenic which kills the median nerve.
And who do you think is the best person to find that, to make that diagnosis?
Well, that's the problem. I can guarantee our students, former students, they're doing absolutely amazing. They're sending clinical cases we published in Journal of Massage Science. And they're just doing, but it's like 60, 70 of them through the different part of the country. It's not like you can easily find that. But generally speaking, I don't have answer because I was invited to speak in annual American Academy of Pain Management gathering. And it's like 250 physicians who were sitting there. And I for 2 hours telling them all theory and all diagnostic evaluation associated with medical massage. And then I finish, ask, so what questions do you have? And there is like forest of hands. And I think that's it. They will eat me alive right now. And then ask first person, so what is your question? The question was, where we can find this therapy? And they said, yeah. I don't know. Any other questions? Basically, no more questions. That is, because you see, from one point of view, American medicine accumulated absolutely unbelievable data about medical massage. A recently published study where the first time scientists here in the United States used DNA analysis to actually observe results of medical massage therapy. They published it in the most prestigious. The physicians right now massaging rats around the country, but all this information stays within medical community, and they are see massage therapists, for example, or physical therapists only as a luxury, not as a treatment option.
Right.
And
right.
Then the massage therapists on the other side have no clue that this information actually already accumulated. And then at the same time, for example, American Massage Therapist Association blocks medical massage from the full exposure because they're afraid to step on the medical community foot. So it's kind of politics on every corner, and that is very unfortunate for the patient.
It is very unfortunate. You know, a lot of times, I know when my dad was a physician, he would say, one thing that you need to do is lay hands on the patient somehow. And, you know, doctors don't do that anymore, much less. I mean, they just don't do it. They what's your symptom? They may order an MRI. They never even touch you. And yet when you look at their notes, it looks like they did a complete history and physical on you. It's just, to me, it's dry labbing, just clicking a bunch of buttons and saying they did something when they really didn't, you know. And it's just hands off now. And, you know, it's kind of sad. Our state of health is terrible. Not only that, for these pain patients, but their patients are obese. They're on too many medications that, and some of them could be mind-altering as well. It's kind of a sad state of affairs. So, you know, in my practice, it's a cash-only practice. I don't fool with insurances and because they get in the way. I don't know about your practice or not, but a lot of times insurance is not going to cover that anyway, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. And what you're saying about the physician actually getting in direct contact with the patient, it is such a critical. I'm lucky that I work with my friend and he work in the family practice. And he does things which he's actually from Serbia. And he does percussion, he does palpation to the degree that patients in shock that that someone doing that. I give you one incredible story. My wife, she works there as a family physician as well. And she did the evaluation of the patient, like physical, yearly physical, young, you know, like 40 years old, truck driver. And she palpated his abdomen. And she just felt that his aorta pounding much more than it's supposed to pound. So as a matter of just I don't know, she couldn't even explain. She just felt it. She sent to our ultrasound technician. Ultrasound technician was running into the room with eyes like size of the plate. And he said, look in that. And there is an aorta aneurysm, 25 centimeters. The patient was from our office transported to the emergency room, and at the same time they did surgery. And the surgeon told him, you need to go to the physician who diagnosed. And thanks her because they saved your life. But and he will be dead. Another 6 months, another month, and he will be dead. And there is no way you can stop an aneurysm from bursting. And all of that. So for the patients who listening right now, you would like to work with family physician who spend time with you and who actually touches you in all places. When he or she is not doing that, change physician.
I agree. You know, and unfortunately, the way physicians are worked now, they don't have time. They have an average of 7 minutes to spend with a patient, and they're on a computer trying to find a code to get the insurance code out for. So that's why I gave up insurance 18 years ago. I just focus on the patient, and, you know, you're exactly right. Isn't that just really telling about what?
Well, because medicine, practice of the medicine becomes business. You know that it's not only business. It's actually the most humane type of activity human can actually do.
Yeah.
And when we're losing this connection with the patient, we're not only not delivering, we're also losing placebo effect, which is 20% of improvement just because physician spend time and explain patient what needs to be done.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, my dad was a very wise physician. He was a general surgeon. He told me a few things down the line that's really I've gone by. One of them is when you're not sure what to do, do something. And he also said, besides, you know, touch your patient, in some form, touch your patient. Let them know there's a connection between you and that patient that needs to be examined. And, you know, there's a lot of wisdom in that. You just don't see it anymore. You just don't, you know, words. And he also said words of comfort, you know, are very important to that patient. We can help you, because that's just not done anymore. You know, it's just...
Again, because of the time, you're absolutely right. But from my perspective, and that's why, for example, in our clinic, patients sometimes waiting for 2 hours to see our physicians. Not because physicians just, you know, lazy. They spend so much time with the patient that, and then patient appreciate it so much, then they willing to wait. Because they know when the day term, they will not spare any time and to actually dedicate. But yeah. From my perspective, personal, and that's what I tell our students as well, if after the first interaction with the patient left your room and he or she doesn't see light at the end of the tunnel, you screwed up your evaluation and your interaction with the patient. Yeah, and that's
exactly right.
Yeah, and that's what unfortunately missing.
It's called words of comfort and hope that you can help them. Otherwise, why are you there?
Yeah,
you
know, that's the light of the end of the tunnel.
You know, I recently ran across a situation where I really use a lot. And so you have a patient come in to your office, and they have everything in the world going on. They have a stack of records this high, and they're seeing a cardiologist, a rheumatologist, an endocrinologist, a gastroenterologist, and a psychiatrist. What I'll say is, are you seeing all those specialists? They go, yes. They go, see the psychiatrist first. So maybe you don't have to see those other patients. You know, a lot of times that I find that people... The other aspect that I don't know if you deal with it much or not, but the other aspect that I see in people that are in chronic pain is there's an emotional component to it, and a lot of times there's trauma behind it. And I know you're more the physical imbalance, but I find trauma and emotional trauma as a cause of a lot of chronic pain. And unless you take the time to get to know the patient, how would you know that?
Yeah, that's part of the problem, definitely. But there is another part of the problem is the presence of the chronic pain itself. And even, let's look on the simple fact, fibromyalgia people, patients. Why 99% of the patients with fibromyalgia females?
Female.
It's not like female body, such as vulnerable compared to male body. There is something else supposed to be behind the situation. And that's actually how the male and female body process pain differently. Because of the childbirth, females has much higher tolerance to acute pain than males. But they have very low threshold for the chronic pain. In males, it's different. We can go with lower back pain for months. Female cannot do that. She can, in 2 weeks, already an emotional crisis. Because your brain doesn't have protection the chronic bombardment of the daily basis. And that's why you have, when the brain constantly bombarded by the chronic pain, eventually start to change the balance of neurotransmitters. And that's what bring you to the
Exactly right. Eventually. That's exactly right. You know, and when you put that together, I think females, a lot of them have had more trauma than males, emotional trauma.
And
it does affect your neurotransmitters and it affects your mu receptors in the brain for pain receptors. Mm-hmm. And it's very true. And a lot of times what I've found is if you talk to them and get to know them and get them along the right path for healing in all aspects, then they're going to be way better off You're getting to the root of the problem.
Yeah, and you know why? Because what you do at this point, when you're doing that, what you describe right now is critical. Because what you did, you transfer this emotional fear, anxiety, or maybe previous trauma from subconscious to conscious. As soon as you transfer it to conscious, then conscious can grip it and hold it and reset it. But when it's staying on the subconscious or unconscious level, it doesn't matter. It will be constantly coming back with it. That's why family physicians are such a critical part of the medicine, because they only those who can control all specialists. So they are only those who see the bigger picture.
Yep.
Instead of addressing here and there pieces of body.
I agree.
And unfortunately, that's not the case in majority.
Yeah. You don't see that much, but I agree with you 100% because I've seen it countless times. And those patients actually get better, you know, and without a pill, with, you know, manual massage, fascial release therapy, and maybe some psychology with it too, you know, and giving them hope. I know we've talked a long time. This has been an amazing discussion. I need to get you back on this podcast at some point. Tell me how some resources from these people you have trained, like Carolyn, how can people, of course, I'm going to put your site on and all that. How, there's not many people that are out there, like you said, that you've trained. What in general, what would you give advice to a person that needs this kind of manual massage therapy, medical?
No, first of all, if they're lucky and the therapist live in the close neighborhood, that's great. If they're looking for potentially people who do at least something, then they're looking for neuromuscular therapy. That will be one of the it's kind of from the perspective that it includes a lot of components in it. So the problem is with the medical massage that each modality in currently available presented as the ultimate solution. As you know, there is no ultimate solution from one modality or technique. It comes from combination of the factors. So neuromuscular therapy is the kind of the most integrative part. People can look who is actually practicing that. That's one thing. What also helpful with early stages of myofascial abnormality, so-called myofascial release. That's also helpful. But then when they going to much smaller, you know, trigger point therapy or, you know, working on the fascia, it doesn't have such integrative approach to soft tissue rehabilitation. So the more variety therapist uses during the therapy, variety of therapy treatments, the more efficient he or she is. Because same patient with same headache, the treatment protocol will be always different from patient to patient, because there is framework and there is variations. The result of the therapy successful come from the therapist able to address variations. That is ultimate solution. But unfortunately, in many cases, people only stuck with the framework, which is not enough. So from that perspective, neuromuscular therapy is number one modality people can look for. And myofascial release also can be helpful as well.
I'm going to make notes of that. I'm going to put all your information up here, Dr. Ross, and we may be able to include some slides and things that will be on the note that we do for this podcast. But I'd like to encourage all the people listening to take note of this and really, really do your homework. You know, find somebody, a doctor or therapist, or that will listen to you and find the origin of your problem and not just throw a medicine or, you know, something that's just not going to work in the long run. You know, get a thorough evaluation. This has been a fascinating conversation, Dr. Ross. Let me ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. And when I've been to Scottsdale, we always go hike this place called Camelback Mountain. Is that still, is that what you do?
It's
you run
there.
Up that every day? You run up that every day?
Not every day. It's still there. So when you come to Scottsdale, let me know.
You gotta watch out for the rattlesnakes, though.
Yeah,
right?
I know. That's why you're not doing that during the summer.
That's exactly right, and it's pretty hot there too.
Yeah.
Last time I was there was during Christmas, but it's a wonderful, beautiful place. And congratulations to you on your wonderful practice and the way you teach other people how to help people. So, Ross, thank you so much, and we'll be in touch. Thank you so much for agreeing to appear on my show from all the way in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I look
forward
to
talking to you, Dr. Rogers. I really appreciated that. Let's keep in touch.
Thank you so much. Very impressive. Okay.
Then,
goodbye.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Thanks again. We'll see you guys next week.
Thank you.